Okay, so let's give it a start. Well, hello and welcome everyone. Welcome Stephen on the show. Yeah. It's all live, all rolling. By the way, this is not my usual studio. I just didn't want to risk a bad connection, so I'm in the living room right now. So that's behind the scenes, a luxurious one, really. Now, Stephen, before we even begin, because we're bringing you on the show, my two questions to start the conversation really is, could you just maybe briefly introduce yourself to us? And secondly, a big one for me is, what is your hope or plan, idea, intention for the podcast, for our listeners?
Absolutely. Okay. So for those listening, for those playing along at home or in their cars, the interesting thing about this episode of Watchers Podcast is I'm one of the few people you meet that's been a senior executive at a couple of motion picture studios, Fox and DreamWorks. I've also raised over $20 million of venture capital and run three startups, one successful exit, two failures. And along the way, I picked up a lot of patterns and tips around how you can be performing at a very high level, but in a way that's sustainable. And as you know, Waj, I just had a child 12 weeks ago. And boy, that even makes your time more precious when you're like, oh, I have like 90 minutes right now. I need to be really efficient with what I get done. So a lot of what I do is share about flow states, about mindful productivity, you know, tips I've seen between film and tech of really high performers and how they do that. So love to share some of those in the next 45 minutes we have together.
Amazing. No, that's wonderful. And well, congrats on the baby.
That's super excited.
That is an amazing. I bet it's a game changer, really, like no other.
Several times a day, he's so adorable. I want to eat him. I'm just like, oh, I want to eat you. You're so cute.
So you said about, you know, we've discussed before the show and via emails as well. You said about the high performance and especially in our day and age, it seems like many people are working maybe not fully remote, but certainly hybrid. You know, I'm one of them. As part of my day job, I'm supposed to be in the office, for example, three times a week. But really, if you think about it, for the most part, as long as the tasks are done, it's more of a intention rather than a policy in place to enforce it. And you know, I don't know about other people, but it's not obvious for me that I'm more productive or as productive at home as in the office. So what are your thoughts about that, especially maybe considering your both creative and entrepreneurial experience?
Let me hang a lantern on something you said, which is that you can be very productive at home, right? Or for some people, that's a coffee shop. For some people, that's traveling, whatever that may be, right? And what I'm noticing is there's a generation of leaders coming up that measure the work of their team by the effect, as opposed to how long did it take? Where did they do it? Like, those sort of things are not actually that important to them. But if you're 50, 60 years old, you're raised in a culture of, well, all of us must be under the same fluorescent lights 12 hours a day, 5-6 days a week, right? And I get a lot of people, because of, by virtue of running the Suka company, I get a lot of people who come to me saying, like, hell, help me understand how to lead a productive team. What can I do to increase the productivity, reduce the burnout on my team, things like that. It's so interesting that younger leaders are very much about, is the effect of my team moving our company forward, as opposed to, I need to know where they are and have them here in the office, right? So if we agree upon the most important thing is the effect of your actions, as opposed to what place you did them in or what time of day, right? Then let's pull back for a moment and talk about, why do some leaders fear hybrid or distributed remote work, asynchronous, whatever term you want to use, right? And I talked to a number of leaders who are concerned about that. They're like, I don't know what, you know, Dave's doing Tuesday at 3 p.m. How do I know he's working on our thing and he's not at the dog park, you know, playing with his dog? So here's the thing. That's a hiring problem. That's not actually a remote work problem. If you as a leader understand it is incumbent upon you to declare a mission. Hey, we are here to cure cancer. We are here to make electric cars. We are here to make great romantic comedy movies, whatever it may be. We are here to do this. And by the way, this is how we're going to treat each other. This is how we're going to treat our collaborators. This is how we're going to treat our competitors, which essentially is values, which is culture, right? So if you as a leader understand, you have to say, here's our mission, here's our culture, and you hire people who match that, the fear of what is Dave doing goes away. Like, suppose I found a company to cure cancer. And watch, I'm talking to you, and you're like, yeah, you know, my grandmother died of cancer. I've been, you know, this is why I went to med school. This is why I was in bioscience. And Tuesday afternoon, I don't have to see you to know that you're moving the ball down the field, because this is something aligns with your mission in life. However, if I'm a bad leader and I hire some guy who's had 5 jobs in 6 years and he's on LinkedIn jobs and, you know, Indeed all the time, I'm an idiot to hire that guy. He's not engaged in our mission and our culture. He's just looking for a job. Then you should be worried what he's doing Tuesday at 3 p.m., right? So I'm a big fan of what is appropriate, which is not to say it has to be in the office or it has to be remote. I will tell you, having worked in a very creative field, film, and a somewhat creative field, you know, tech, there are moments that that's also creative. I've never had a creative brainstorm over Zoom or Google Meet or Teams that was as rich as being in the room with someone. There is something about being around a whiteboard and drawing things together and looking at each other and just feeling each other's energy that doesn't come through on Zoom. And it's not to say I hate remote work. It's just to say, when I really have to do that kind of thing with my team to say, let's brainstorm this new feature or let's look at our next quarter, I really like us to get together. But when I say, hey, Waj, you need to, you know, look for these bugs, debug this feature, right? Oh, Steven, you need to build this new thing. Oh, go do whatever you want. Do it in a coffee shop. I don't care. Do it in the field. Do it in your backyard, you know, by your fire pit. There's no need for you to be sitting like where I can watch you, right? So that's what I feel about remote, hybrid, distributed, asynchronous, RTO, whatever part of that you want to pick up.
It's curious, you know, something that stood out for me, and before we maybe go into that creativity part, something that I observe, and maybe the problem is really that they are not leaders rather than managers, but there also seems to be this dynamic of if someone is trying to constantly check on you and micromanage, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, you're almost pushing. It's like, if you know, if you're pushing against something, someone will push back, right? So if you start abusing, you know, people's attention span by just constantly checking in on them and maybe asking like, what have you worked on today, or even literally like, show me your screen. No wonder then that, in my opinion, that might actually create the dynamic that someone will start to sort of log off, because it's their way of running away from this, you know? So you're sort of, your expectation is creating the outcome for that someone.
See, this is the thing, is this is going to go a little bit deep for a moment, but I believe that we all have something great inside us. And the question of this lifetime is, are you going to get it out, or are you going to die with it and still inside you? And that thing does not have to be an app or a tech company. It can be a restaurant. It could be a great novel. It could be a number of things, right? But once you believe that people have something great inside them, that drives the idea of productivity. Because if you're just being productive or forcing someone to be productive with no belief that they have greatness, no belief that you have greatness, then what are you doing? Like, it's, you know, there's no point to it. So if you as a leader view your job as seeing, identifying the greatness in the people that you hire and giving them the conditions to draw it out of them, that's very different than, like you said, a manager who's like, hey, Waj, you know, Friday at 10 a.m., I really need that TPS report turned in. That's a manager. That's not a leader, right? So I think that's a great way to think about leadership, is to say, these are the roles I need. It's like, I love to use a Michael Jordan example, because you don't need to apply pressure on a high performer to perform. You don't need to tell Michael Jordan, who's one of the probably the greatest basketball player of all time, hey, we need more points on the board. You know, if you do that, it's almost counterproductive. He's like, I'm already the best in the league. My internal structure makes me want to perform. You don't need to point at the scoreboard and say, how many points did you score in this game, right? And you need to hire that way. You need to hire people who say, this is important to me as an identity thing, that I'm helping to cure cancer, that I am coming up with a hospital for dogs, that I am, you know, creating the best French restaurant in, you know, Austin, Texas, whatever that may be. Is when someone is passionate about that, you don't need to have those metrics forced upon them. Like you said, share your screen. Let me see what you're doing. Tell me three things you did today of value. You know, that's just a way of saying, how do I lay you off? How do I find reasons to get rid of you?
I think the metrics here is really something also like, and it's not obvious for me that that all companies think of it this way, as you just mentioned. It's not obvious for me that everyone will think that it's valuable to think of a person like that. And if the metrics are set up in a way to measure your time spent on a task, but you're not actually being, you know, this is a personal experience of mine. I've had an experience before in my life where a manager actually ended up pretty much punishing my efficiency because it was so unexpected for him that I have finished so quickly.
Yeah.
And he didn't like the fact that I pushed back when he said that I should continue working on it. And I basically said that, you know, he's welcome to check it now and see the outcome. And he couldn't find anything wrong about it. So he made a point of making sure that my manager gave me so much work that I couldn't possibly finish it within the next 2 days, just to drive, you know, sort of like, I felt like I'm being pushed down. Yeah. Because
did that inspire you to greatness?
Exactly.
Or did you want to leave?
Exactly. So my question to you here is like, what if you had this situation as part of your consultancy before? Do you like, you know, what is the hope there? Because essentially what I feel is, first you would have to start with the managerial maybe education, change of culture, for that to even be available, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are huge shifts in how leaders, managers see themselves. When you think about coming from an agrarian, you know, workforce in the fields to an industrial workforce in factories to, you know, the information age workforce. And now, you know, in the age of LLMs, which people generally use AI to mean LLM, in the age of LLMs, there are a lot of jobs that are changing. Like, it's changed how I write code. You know, like my partner and I can generate massive amounts of code that we used to have teams of developers to do. And now it'll do its own bug reports. You know, it's like really amazing. So this continues to evolve, but the leaders have to evolve from the ones that are in the fields with people farming to the assembly line workers in the factories to the managers, you know, in the cubicle farms with the fluorescent lights to now a world where, I mean, everyone's saying, who's going to be the first unicorn company that's a solo founder? You know, and how different that's going to be, and how that would be unthinkable 5 years ago. Before LLMs, no one would say that. And now it's a question, who's going to do it?
Yeah.
So 14-year-old out of China.
So before we go into the creative field, I just wanted to ask you then, maybe a few, you know, we don't have to go through all of them, but from your experience, maybe a few guiding principles or tools for managers or for leaders, for managers to become leaders or for leaders to be effective leaders, you know, in the spirit of our conversation so far.
It's a fantastic question. And I'm going to speak to the thing I'm passionate about, which is flow states. So let me talk about that so that everyone knows what we're talking about. And then let's talk about how you can create those conditions, right? So we built Suka is a flow state app. So I naturally get questions from managers. They go somewhat like this. Hey, you know, four of my guys that are, you know, engineers, my team use this. I wanted to see if we get licenses for everyone. How does this work? What is this thing? So here's the deal. We built a flow state app. What is a flow state? I know there's a portion of your audience, they're flow masters. They know all about flow states.
Great.
There's another portion that's heard about it because it's in the zeitgeist, but don't really know. So let's just define it. There was a Hungarian American psychologist, this guy Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. He had a thesis. He said, you talk to high performers in very different disciplines, athletes and scientists and artists and inventors. And when they talk about the concentrated states where they do the thing that makes them famous, they very often talk about it in similar ways, even though what they do is very different. Michael Jordan is very different than Picasso, who's very different than Einstein, right? So he's like, what's up with that? So he did the research. At the end of it, he wrote a book called Flow. It's the seminal work on this. It is the reason we call it a flow state. And he said the greatest thing. He said, I chose this word because it was the most beautiful metaphor for what I found. We are all on the river, paddling to move ourselves forward. But if you align your boat with the current, it carries you. It magnifies your efforts. You go further and faster. And he said, that is what these high performers have figured out how to do and how to do it repeatably. And it's a fascinating book. And you and I live in a world, very gratefully, where really smart minds have dug into his research and extended it. Oh, let's go deeper on the neuroscience of this. Let's go deeper on how does, you know, distraction work with Near and Kotler talking and Cal Newport talking about deep work. And, you know, we benefit from all that. Anything smart that I say on this podcast is the result of people spending their lives trying to understand deep work, flow states, you know, how does our mind get to this place? And it is a neuroscientific thing. Like, they put jazz musicians that were like in improv, in flow with each other, in fMRI machines. And it's true, like your prefrontal cortex activity decreases. Like your brain activity actually changes when you're in flow. You lose sort of a sense of self. You become immersed in the work. And Mihai wrote about this even before some of the, you know, the neuroscience research. He said, across the board, here's what you hear from these people. They lose track of time. You're not staring at the clock. You do some of your best work in a compressed amount of time. Distractions fall away. You're not thinking about going to the fridge to grab a snack. You know, you're not thinking about walking the dog. You're deep in it. You lose sort of your sense of self, become part of a greater wave. And he said at the end, you often feel a sense of like joy or uplift as opposed to a sense of depletion. And I had never heard of a flow state. The first time I experienced a flow state, I was kind of like, wow, what just happened? I was flying here from Austin, you know where I live, and I was going to San Francisco. The next day, I wanted to show my team an idea, like mock up a rough version of a feature I wanted us to build. And my Figma skills are enough, I can kind of pull it together, right? So I thought, I'll get on the flight, mock this up. We get on, Alaska Airlines runs that route from Austin to SFO. Captain's like, hey, everybody, Wi-Fi is broken. So sorry, you know, see you in San Francisco. So we take off. 15, 20 minutes later, we start descending. And I was like, okay, we're in Dallas. Like, we're still in Texas somewhere. And there's like a hydraulic problem. There's something wrong with the plane. And when we're on the ground, they're going to tell us because they don't want to scare us now and say like, oh, the engine fell off. Right, we're going to land. I look down, over 2 hours and 40 minutes have gone by. We were landing in San Francisco. I had no concept of that. I couldn't tell you if the drink cart came by. I couldn't tell you the name of the guy in the seat next to me. But my designs were done, and I really liked them. And I don't know if you've done this, but I had prepared myself for, okay, grab my roller bag, get in the Uber. I'll grab a sandwich in the lobby of the hotel, and then go up to the room, and I'll finish the designs and pass out, right? Designs were done. I called a friend of mine from the Uber and said, hey, man, I've got a free night in SF. Do you want to have dinner? And it felt great for a change to be ahead of my day than chasing my day. Later, friends talked to me, and we were talking about this sort of thing. I said, well, that's actually a flow state, and there's some great research on it, which led me down this path to learn about what the smart minds had written. And I was like, why didn't someone tell me this in college? Like, why didn't someone tell me this years ago? It would have been amazing. So that is a lot of what I find to be interesting, is to understand what are the conditions that help you get into flow state? What are the best practices for that? And you asked me a question around, like, what can leaders do, or what can you do as a leader of your own brain to do this? And I'll tell you, I'll give you some anecdotes. It's a fun way to talk about ideas, right? When I was in my early 20s, just getting into film, there is a famous writer, written Rain Man, My Best Friend's Wedding, like a bunch of big movies, right? He writes like movie star kind of roles. This guy, Ron Bass. And he was famous for not talking to his family in the morning. And he said, you know, I'm not the dad who's going to be like, hey, you know, who wants eggs? And, you know, do you need a ride to school? He's like, I can't talk to you, because once I start talking to you, I can't hear my character's voice in my head. And he knew he had to use that time from like 5, 6 a.m. to like 9, 10 a.m. for that. In the afternoon, he could do studio meetings. He could do collaborations. He could do talks with his agent, you know, whatever, right? And his family's very cool about it. They're like, you know, dad's making $2 million a script. They're like, we can make the pancakes, dad. We got you. Don't worry. Right? And I remember hearing the story and thinking, that's amazing. He is so self-aware that he understands this, which is the concept of chronotype, that you're more adept at certain kinds of work at certain kinds of day, at certain times of day. And this is a simple thing to figure out for yourself. Like, you can take a piece of paper, draw a little grid, you know, morning and afternoon, Monday through Friday, and you can do it for 2 weeks if you want, and just jot down at a high level, what did you do? How'd you feel? Oh, Tuesday afternoon, I worked on my blog. Man, didn't go so well. Thursday morning, I was coding this thing. Da, da, da. Oh, worked really well. You will be astonished when you look at that after a week or 2 weeks. You'll see the patterns and you'll say, oh my God, I should always be, you know, doing this kind of work in the afternoon or this kind of work early in the morning, because that's how your natural rhythms are. That's how your brain works. So that idea of chronotype, free, just a free tip. Learn about yourself. It'll take you through the rest of your life, right? And then every now and then check in. Maybe, you know, over 10, 20 years, like, you change, but at least understand that sort of thing. Another one that's kind of odd is, I noticed when I was getting into film, I got into film because I was working in visual effects, doing digital, like, computer-generated effects for movies. That was how I got into the studio system. And I did produce the digital effects for Independence Day, which we won the Academy Award for Visual Effects, which is great, right? So Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin, who are the director, producer, writers, I remember, and I was 22, 23 maybe, and I was just kind of like, how did this happen? Because they, I learned, had written most of their scripts at some vacation villa down in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Apparently a beautiful white marble villa in the hills of Puerto Vallarta, right? So Roland had told his assistant, we have to write the next script, go rent the villa. So the assistant came back and said, hey, I just checked, it's rented already. You know, it was like an Airbnb, you know, before Airbnb, but it was just someone else had rented it. Roland called his entertainment attorney, this guy John Beamer is a fantastic attorney, and said, John, buy the villa. By Monday, Roland owned that villa in Puerto Vallarta. I don't know where the current renters went. I'm sure we were paid nicely to find another vacation rental. And, you know, I'm a little kid from Virginia. I was not raised where you drive. Yeah. None of this made sense to me. So I was talking to Dean. I was like, can you help me understand, like, what just went down? And Dean said, listen, there's a room in this villa where in the morning the light comes in over the pool. And we never think in that room about cast availabilities or studio notes or what's the budget going to be. He said, we just write the movie that we would want to see. So it's worth it for us, in this case, to do what we can to get that space. And that was the first time I started tracking, like, how people train their brains to have, like, this mental space associated with the physical space. And it is not to say you need a $5 million villa, because I'll tell you, years later, when I was at DreamWorks, is an executive vice president with Kurtzman Orsi. Alex Kurtzman and Bob Orsi, for those who don't know, they were the guys who wrote Transformers 1 and 2 and Star Trek 11 and Eagle Eye and Zorro, Mission Impossible 3, all sorts of stuff, Fringe, like tons of stuff, Hawaii 5-0. Great guys. And when they got under the gun to finish something, they would often rent right across the street. We were on the Amblin compound at Universal Studios in Hollywood. So right across Lancashire is Universal Hilton. It's not a glamorous property. It's an okay hotel. You know, it's where you go and stay before you go on the rides at Universal. And they would rent a room there for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And I was like, these guys are making, again, like, you know, $1-2 million a script. They could go to Bali. They could go anywhere to go write this. Why would they go to this, you know, 3-star hotel across the street? And I realized they had met back in school. And I think being there in that hotel room with, like, you know, one of them at the edge of the bed on his laptop and, you know, Bob at the desk on his MacBook, it evoked for them like dorm room. Mm. It brought them back to that. Oh, with these young, scrappy writers who have to prove that, you know, we're worth it. And they would write Transformers 2 in 3 weeks. You know, it was an interesting mental sort of a hack for them to be like, this gets us in that flow more than sitting in our beautiful office across the street at DreamWorks.
That is so true. You know, first of all, in terms of the flow state, we've had both the episode about Csikszentmihalyi's book and also the Chronotype. So I'll link below for all of you out there who can't get enough of this. But my personal experience with flow state, and maybe this will lead to a question actually that I've been mulling over. It seems to me, my experience is, first of all, mornings, 100%. And especially, I have a certain morning routine that, with tiny variations, has stayed the same essentially for the past, I don't know, 7 years. And that routine allowed me to both write, read, you know, this is what I do as my enjoyment in the morning, as my way to sort of ground myself and stuff, some meditation here and there. And the one thing that I wanted to maybe follow up with for you is, how can we help people that are not necessarily doing things at work, for example, that they are so passionate about, to potentially reap the benefits of a flow state? Because I find, for example, that even though I'm sometimes doing tasks that are not necessarily, you know, my cup of tea, because of having been through this state again and again, and because of a certain way that I just go about my things, I feel like I'm actually reaping the benefits of it, even with activities that are not necessarily my, you know, favorite ones.
Okay, that's, I have to interrupt you. That's very interesting, because, I mean, you've read, you know, Mihai's books. One of the things that he said he found to be true is some of the conditions for being in a flow state are, you know, you have skills that apply, that you're doing the activity at a level that challenges you, so you're not bored, that you think what you're doing is meaningful. And what you're saying is you were able to get into a flow state even if you didn't really think what you're doing is that meaningful. That's interesting, because that is one of the conditions that he found to be pretty universally true. So
yeah, well, yeah. maybe this is an overkill to say that it was a flow state. No, you know, don't get me wrong, it's certainly not the same kind of experience as doing like writing or recording a podcast. That's one of the activities that I'm also like, I just can't wait to do it. But maybe what I mean here then is, what advice from your experience would you give to people that have not experienced it or don't know that they did to start getting into that flow?
There are some things that, like, for example, we created the Suka, the website, as a flow state app to help people get into flow. So we did a lot of research on things that help. What are the conditions that help? One of them, and there's a lot of research around this, is music, or even just sound. Let's just say sound, right? So the research shows that the sweet spot for most people is music that's 60 to 90 beats per minute, certain key signatures, you know, melodic, non-vocal, so you're not singing along with you know, Britney Spears or whatever, Blackpink, you know. There's long melodic passages. And we all have the friend, admittedly, who's the outlier. It's like, oh, my friend listens to the
techno
soundtrack, or classical yeah. music, or 90s gangster rap, or whatever it is. Like, we all have the friend who's the outlier, right?
Yeah.
But for most people, that is it. Let's say when we started building Suco, we're like, okay, music is a big one. People, to get into flow state, will need to have a bunch of playlists. And, you know, I have a bunch of friends who are film composers with time on their hands, right? So it's like, hey, here are the guidelines. You write like 1,000 hours of original music sort of to these guidelines. So they did. We organized it into, you know, like lo-fi, more upbeat, some down-tempo ones, you know, things like that. I'll tell you, I learned a lot. Here's one of the things I learned. A buddy of mine, Julian, in Marin, just north of San Francisco, he does the sound mixing for a lot of the LucasArts, the Star Wars games. He called me up. We're in the middle of this. And he said, hey, you know, I just got back from Nepal. It was my son's high school graduation present. I guess his son did well in high school and got into good college. And his gift was, where do you want to go? He said, Nepal, right? So he said, we were in Kathmandu one day and it poured rain so heavy we couldn't go out. There's this lush, delicious, like, rain in the Himalayas. And he said, I did have some of my recording equipment, so I recorded it, like 2 hours of rain without really knowing what I was going to do with it. And I remember you had that Focus app. Do you want this music? And I was like, for free? I'll take, you know, this soundtrack of rain. So he and I quietly put up a playlist in the middle of all the music playlists, quietly put up a playlist that is just 2 hours of rain, and we called it Himalayan Dream Rain. It became the third most popular playlist in our platform with no advertising, no marketing, no... People just found it and turned it on. And I thought this was fascinating, right? So I run the platform, so I know everyone's email. So I emailed a couple of people that I saw listening to it. I said, can I talk to you? I'd love to learn why you listen to rain. You know, like, we have all this beautiful music, custom designed to best practices, and you're listening to rain. What? And this is what I learned. It was a lot like the mental space, physical space thing. Essentially what the people I spoke to said in their own way was, it brings me back to a period of time in my life when I had to study or I had to work, whatever, and there was a lot of rain. Like, oh, I grew up in Georgia. Whenever it was finals time, it was usually when the rains hit. So my memories of rain are staying inside, like focusing and getting ready for finals. That's right. My grandmother had a house. We had a lake house. Like, it was all these stories around, I remember it raining when I had to be inside and do this work. So now when I hear rain, it helps me just close down and focus on the thing in front of me. And I thought that was fascinating. So we experimented, because once I learned this, I was like, oh, why don't we try a stream? We found someone recorded a stream in Japan. Someone recorded the surf in Cyprus. Someone recorded a lake in Canada near where my partner lives. We put them up. Some people listened to them. They were not like big hits like The Rain. And I thought, okay, so it's really rain was the one that for people was like that mental trigger. And I got a message. There's a pretty well-known female blogger who is in our platform in Suco. And she reached out to me. She said, I see you're experimenting with non-musical playlists. I have a request.
All right, what?
She said, so before the pandemic, I would always go to this coffee house near me somewhere outside London to write my blog. I had a child. I had a baby during the pandemic. I can't really pick up with an 18-month-old or 2-year-old or whatever and, you know, go to a coffee shop. Is there any chance you could put up a playlist of, like, what a coffee shop sounds like? Okay. So we scoured the internet. We found a guy in Vienna, Austria, who had recorded his local coffee shop and asked if we could throw this up just as a test. Just like, can we see this? And it's just the sound of, you know, the espresso, like, shh, and the little plates clattering and the murmur of background voices.
I think it helps as well that it's not audible in terms of language, right?
Exactly. Yes. Again, super popular. And I was like, wow. Okay. So, and I think more so with writers, that one is popular. Because there's You know, about the writer culture being in a coffee shop.
If anything, Stephen, it seems to me that we've hit the nail on the head. Like, each one of us, or unless they've not experienced it before, but I think pretty much everyone did, they might not know about it, has a certain anchoring sound, yes, or place or right, activity or maybe a smell, you know. For me, for example, it's the music of Ludovico Einaudi. I've been listening to Ludovico Einaudi for so many years, for basically, you know, he has only so many pieces there. He keeps creating, but essentially the list is limited. By now I know them by heart, and these are exactly this is the playlist that I play whenever I'm doing like deep work, reading, writing, sometimes working, you know, whatever that might be. And of course I enjoy it in my day to day, but yeah, as you said earlier, and I'm curious to learn whether or not Einaudi's beats are around 60 to 90. I assume. Yeah, right? I wonder, but you know, my point is, this is probably the anchor for me, for example.
Yes.
And I wouldn't be surprised that for example, have you heard about the bonfire, the crackling bonfire sound on YouTube that by now made like 3 yes, million, because people just love to hear to the sound of the, you know, crackling fire.
Yeah.
I bet it's also the same thing, that people just maybe have a, you know, memory of their grandparents or parents' house.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, I have a different question for you. When you are working, and I respect you have a flow practice already, but when you are working and you're trying to stay in flow, what are the distractions that do pull you out? What are the things that get you?
Well, in the office, it certainly is when people come up to me and want something. And that's just a no-brainer. If anything, I would argue that it should be like an accepted practice to have headphones in the job that I am right now. Yeah. It is accepted, but I've worked before in a company that it was forbidden, and I think that was a tragedy because you're basically constantly stimulated.
Yep.
In terms of my own distractions, I just have to keep myself really safe of not picking up my phone. And this is the one thing that I think many of us are struggling with. If you don't put the phone away before you start, it's very difficult to not catch yourself,
Every time I speak to a live audience, I ask that question, and the phone is always the number one answer.
We're 100% addicted.
Beautifully designed. Every vibration, every sound, every pixel of color has been A/B tested a billion times over to be so attractive, right? So I have another question for you. Suppose you were working on something, and I was sitting next to you as your friend. When you reached for your phone, I simply said to you, hey, I see you reaching for your phone. Is that going to help you get, you know, whatever you're working on done? Would that be enough for you to say, oh, you know, you're right, I don't want to pick it up? Or would you still pick it up?
Well, you know, it's I would love to jump on a high horse and say that that would be enough, but I don't know. Quite frankly, I would hope to think that that's the case, but I also... I definitely believe it depends on the situation, on the person. Like, for example, with my wife, I'm pretty sure I would respond positively to such an invitation from her. It's not obvious for me that she would appreciate the same comment about her picking up the phone, simply because we have different standards of self-correcting, let's say. Like, I'm much more harsh on myself than she is on herself. And right, thanks to that, she's living a more relaxed life. Because of it, I'm she's my wife for a reason, but yeah, because of that as well, I can definitely be much more neurotic, in a sense of, if you point this, and this is really valuable for me to be discussing it, because if you point it to me, I might just end up excruciating myself over it, over, you know, for the next few tens of minutes while I'm figuring out how to deal with it. So for sure. But at the same time, as I said, you know, you never know how you're going to react until you do. So it is a curious invitation. Now, okay. So
I have a related question before you go on. Question.
Yeah.
I agree with you on the phone. Are there websites on your desktop, laptop where you find you lose time? Are there distracting websites for you?
No.
Your phone.
Yeah, to be honest, the thing is, the only space where I end up clicking through, if I end up like, you know, immersed in my phone again, are checking if someone did the move on chess going on Primal, which is basically like X, but slightly different. But I found that Primal is, it's not as bad as X because there is a limited amount of users that you see the feed from. And so once you check it once or twice during the day, it doesn't change much. So I try to stop myself from doing that, but the response is still there. In terms of the screen of a laptop, not necessarily. I have a laptop that doesn't allow me to play any games, and I've been working for the past pretty much 10 years, so it's been a while since I've been like playing, you know. For if anything, I find that the most distracting thing at home for me, if I am working from home, is when my job is boring, is getting the books, starting to read a book, you know. But that's not really what we're talking about here, because if I'm not in a flow state, then realistically, you know, basically I'm just bored. And that's the problem of the activity.
Totally makes sense. So here's the funny thing is, we were researching, you know, how to build this platform. We looked at this aspect of distractions, right? And like Nir Eyal has written fantastic. He was a coach for us. He's written fantastic stuff about, you know, traction, distraction, you know, internal, external triggers and all that. And there are a number of apps, Chrome extensions, apps, you know, whatever, that you can get to help you block distractions so you can get into flow and not be distracted, right? And a lot of them are complete blockers. Hey, cold turkey, freedom, like whatever. You go to this website, we will block it today. You try and open this on your phone, we'll block you from opening your phone. And the weird thing is, there was an aspect of that that as we were designing Suka, we're like, it doesn't feel quite right to me, because it almost feels like there's an assumption you're a child who just can't stop eating ice cream.
Someone's doing the job for you. Yeah.
Yeah. And where we ended up was much more, if you asked me while I was working, I get distracted and you said, hey, is that helping you? Like, do you want to get out of here on time? All I need is that kind of like little nudge for me to say to myself, who do I want to be? Do I want to be the guy who gets out and go plays with his 12-week-old son? Or do I want to be a guy who at the end of the day is like, oh man, I was busy, I don't know, I didn't get everything done, grumble, 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 you know? And we thought that was a more adult way to treat people, to say, hey, we're just going to nudge you. You know, you open up Amazon, Etsy, ESPN, you know, whatever, Facebook. You just get a little modal that just goes, hey, it seems like Facebook's a distraction. Do you want to keep using it? You can say yes or no, but it allows you that moment to decide who do you want to be. You know, same thing with your phone. Like if I pick up my phone while I'm working in Suka, my little smart assistant in the laptop says, hey, I see you on your phone. Is that helping? And I just get to choose. If I want to waste my time in TikTok or X or Twitter or whatever, I can do it. But I get that moment as an adult to be like, who do I want to be? And that to me feels more like the kind of person who's actually in a flow practice. Like the people who need to be blocked all the time, they're probably not going to be in flow. They're not at that place where they're going to really appreciate the flow state.
Oh, if anything, just remind me, Stephen, how much time do we have left? So I don't want to...
7 minutes.
Okay, yeah. So so on that front, my intuition tells me straight away that, quite frankly, some people just, until they want to get helped, you know, there is a saying that you can take a horse to water, but you cannot make it drink. Yeah.
Yes.
I see it in the office every day, right? People that on one side, they will spend numerous times in their, you know, during the day scrolling through whatever they're scrolling. I don't know. And at the same time, those are the same people that tell me by the end of the day that they are so busy. There is so much to do. They've not managed to do it.
Completely agree with you.
But I don't really think that that's the first. In terms of these people, first they need to get over this sort of lack of agency before we can start working on the flow state, right? Because essentially it's like a patient that has not even showed up to the doctor yet. And you're already trying to...
I love your analogy.
Okay. You know, like you're already prescribing the medicine while they don't even know that they're ill. Like it's kind of pointless in that sense.
Can I pick up on that? Which is, if you yourself don't believe that you have something meaningful to do, then great, waste your life, you know, do whatever. I mean, if you look at the most valuable companies in the U.S. stock market, their business model is simply steal your life, period, full stop.
Attention stealers.
That's it. 10 years ago, this thing is 10 years ago, there was someone embarrassed about it, like Zuckerberg would have to testify at the U.S. Congress. And they would be grilling him, and he would sort of laugh and be like, "Oh, Senator, you know, Facebook's just here to show grandmothers videos of their grandkids. That's what we do, you know." Now, they're not all embarrassed. If you listen to the shareholders' calls, they are straight up. Listen, we have $1 trillion. We are buying the best engineers, the best designers, the best behavioral economists, the best psychologists, to deploy these techniques to steal everyone's lives, which we call shareholder value. And next quarter, we're going to use these new techniques to steal more people's lives. And that will build the stock price. And it sounds ridiculous, but it is as if Mark Zuckerberg called you up and said, "Hey, you know, Waj, I want your life. I'm going to sell it to these advertisers and I'll keep the money, but I'm going to give you some dancing cat videos. Is that cool, buddy?"
Yeah.
And if you have nothing, if you don't believe you have something to do in this lifetime, yeah, you'll say yes. And you'll end up 80 years old on the sofa, scrolling and double tapping so that Mark can have another 457-foot yacht.
Yeah. If anything, Stephen, on this note, maybe we could reconvene at some point in the near future and talk on the energy / like the bigger picture, because this is certainly up the street of what the show I aim to create here. You know, it's,
let me know when you want to. I'd love to.
It's a travesty and tragedy, I think, to allow people, and I think it's for a reason. It's not allow, it's literally we are, in many ways, we are trained to behave this way. And unfortunately, many people, as you said, will spend their whole life in this trance, I guess, can we call it that?
Yeah. Consumption
trance. for sure, that's a whole rabbit hole to dive into. Now, I'm aware of your time, conscious of it. So let's wrap up. I usually invite a guest to, you know, we've given plenty of tools and tips and stuff. But is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience? Of course, we'll put the link below to Suka and to all the other materials that you might share with me. But is there anything else you'd like to leave the audience with? Maybe some...
What did we not
pick up as well, you know?
I would say this, which is, if there is one thing that you can do going forward, this is the thing I would encourage you to do. When you wake up in the morning, before you start scrolling through your inbox, make breakfast, do whatever you're doing, decide with yourself, what is the one thing you could do today that moves your life forward? And hold on to that attention and make sure that you do that thing before you go to bed. Not 5 things, not 10 things, not a vague thing, not I'll think about it later. But when you get up, say, what's the one thing that will move my life forward? It may be I should outline chapter three of my book. It may be I should finish the business plan for my company. It may be I should finish that course that I need. Just know that one thing in the morning and do it, and you'd be surprised how quickly that compounds.
That's wonderful. It's that 1%, right?
But it is that 1%, exactly.
But it's also the Pareto distribution there for sure, that you choose that one to leverage rather than, that's wonderful. Well, you know, if anything, Stephen, thank you so much.
Super fun. Thank you for staying up late to do this with me.
Not at all. Thank you for staying up away from your child to give me this time, you know, this precious time of yours, which... time is precious, really. So let's be in touch, you know. Thank you so much for all of you out there who are listening right now, or in the future, or in the past. Time does not exist.
Everyone who listened this far.
And thank you so much, Stephen. That's been an amazing
night.
One.